Superclass: The Global Power Elite and the World They Are Making, by David Rothkopf. Narrated by Patrick Lawler. Copyright 2008 by David Rothkopf. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux, and was produced in the year 2008 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Preface. God is on everyone's side, and in the last analysis he is on the side with plenty of money and large armies. Jean Anouilh. This is a book about power. It is about the fact that power is concentrated in the hands of a remarkably small number of people around the world. It is about who they are, how they compare to the elites of the past, and how they differ from the rest of us. Most of all, it is about the profound impact this group has on our lives and how it is shaping our times. Power is, of course, hard to quantify. Wealth is often a source of power. Position regularly translates into power. Perhaps the most ancient source of power is the ability to project violent force. But sometimes power is grounded in subtler things, like access or ideas. There is no single or universally accepted metric for power, so a certain amount of subjective judgment is inevitable. Determining who has it and who does not is made more difficult because some of the most influential among us commonly mask their power or use it infrequently. What is more, only a very few people have the sort of international power that is the subject of this book. Many of those we are accustomed to thinking of as powerful actually have very limited impact in a global sense. Formidable as they may be, they are figures of only local or national importance. A global elite has emerged over the past several decades that has vastly more power than any other group on the planet. Each of the members of this superclass has the ability to regularly influence the lives of millions of people in multiple countries worldwide. Each actively exercises this power, and they often amplify it through the development of relationships with others in this class. The age of inherited lifelong power is largely behind us, and for most members of the group, influence is transitory. To truly be a member of this superclass, one has to hold on to power for at least long enough to make an impact, to enter or affect the world of other members of this superclass, a period of a couple of years or more. That such a group exists is indisputable. Heads of state, CEOs of the world's largest companies, media barons, billionaires who are actively involved in their investments, technology entrepreneurs, oil potentates, hedge fund managers, private equity investors, top military commanders, a select few religious leaders, a handful of renowned writers, scientists, and artists, even terrorist leaders and master criminals meet the above criteria for membership. By posing the idea of the existence of a superclass, some key questions emerge. The most obvious is, how big is it? Using the above parameters and combing systematically through publicly available resources, my researchers and I identified just over 6,000 people who qualify. As will become clear, it is a choice based on natural cutoff points, providing us with a group that is both small enough to analyze in some rational way and large enough to encompass all the core international communities from politics, business, the military, and the world of ideas needed for it to be representative of the most important sources of power worldwide. The most common question I have been asked since undertaking this book is there a list? As it happens, there is. Many people have suggested I publish it, partly because people love lists, but mostly because many of those who are members of the superclass, or who aspire to be, are interested in seeing who is in and who is not. But publishing such a list would be an exercise in futility. The day after it was published, it would be obsolete. As I noted earlier, power is transient. Many members of the superclass qualify because of jobs they hold, but people come and go from such jobs. Some retire, some die, others suffer financial or professional calamities. Some members of the group are each year deposed. Others are incarcerated. For these reasons, I have attempted to include a few sublists to illustrate the overall nature of the group. But I have done so with the clear recognition that I am painting a picture of a moving object. Some, mostly Americans, have suggested that by using the word class, I am at risk of entering the intellectually disreputable territory of Marxism and class warfare. If acknowledging what is obvious to any sentient being, that social and economic classes remain in the world, even as mobility between those classes has improved for a few subsets of humankind, is intellectually disreputable, well, then I'm all for it. In fact, I embrace it. This book is, by its nature, very much about the gross inequality in the distribution of power and wealth in the world. My position is that these are issues we ignore at our peril, in practical terms, in political terms, and perhaps most of all, in moral terms. The reality is that the combined net worth of the world's richest 1,000 or so people, the planet's billionaires, is almost twice that of the poorest 2.5 billion. The human race may have made great progress over the centuries, but such disparities are an indictment of our civilization, and, I believe, they are a threat to its stability. Having said that, this is not an Eat the Rich book. I'll admit I am disgusted by the behavior of some of the world's richest, those who pathologically acquire and give back on average something like 1% of what they make to society. A far cry from the almost 90% Andrew Carnegie gave back during his lifetime. And certainly one cannot help but be disturbed and often horrified by those who abuse political or military power, often to the detriment of the most helpless. But there are many deservedly respected and accomplished members of the superclass, individuals who have offered a great deal to the world. In every pursuit there are the best and the brightest, the people who rise to the top by virtue of their merits, and immense good often comes from their leadership. So, in the end, every era has its elites, and has a complex relationship with them. This is also not a volume for conspiracy theorists. I do believe that some of the networks that exist among the most powerful people in the world have enabled a remarkable few to shape the global system, and often to set the terms of our discussions about that system. But I have seen enough of the world of backroom conversations and discreet meetings of the powerful to know that conspiracies are hard to come by. These elites are, in fact, riven with differences and challenged by the practical impossibility of most conspiracies. Old fantasies about world domination just don't add up. In the course of writing this book, I have looked pretty long and hard at a number of theories regarding who runs the world, and at the rumors that swirl around high-level conclaves of the superclass, such as Davos and Bilderberg, the Trilateral Commission, and the Bohemian Grove. I'll admit I certainly would not want to miss out on such global conspiracies, were they to exist and offer me a spot. As John Lehman, former U.S. Secretary of the Navy, once said, "Power corrupts. Absolute power is kind of neat." I had lunch with Edward Shevardnadze shortly after he had stepped down as foreign minister of the former Soviet Union, and he had unabashedly expressed a similar thought. The collapse of the USSR had already taken place, and he was, it seemed, relieved by it. He was relaxed and chatty, enjoying a good meal at Windows on the World, the restaurant that used to be on the top floor of the World Trade Center in Manhattan. A discussion broke out about power and the abuse of power, and after a while Shevardnadze, no longer obliged to couch his words in diplomatic terms, said, "You know, I know something about totalitarianism. I have been a totalitarian ruler, and I have to admit it was a great job while it lasted." Everyone laughed, and soon after Shevardnadze took the democratic route to becoming the president of the Republic of Georgia, where he ruled again for many years. As a Jew, I have always had a particularly soft place in my heart for the old notion of a world Jewish conspiracy. I figured there were not so many Jews, and so, if we were in control, the odds were pretty good I could secure a respectable position in the inner workings of the world domination machinery. I had a friend who used to assert that such a conspiracy really did exist, and that he was responsible for global zinc prices. As far as I can tell, however, either there is no such conspiracy, or I have been the victim of some kind of special discrimination against Jews from New Jersey, or Jews who would be unable to keep the conspiracy a secret if we were let in on it. To this day, I am always astonished when people attempt to assert that somehow Jews are running the show, when the headlines of the past several millennia of Jewish history include exile, the Inquisition, the Holocaust, the acquisition of a tiny desert nation surrounded by enemies, and more or less relentless hatred and abuse. Had we really been in charge, surely we could have done better on all counts. Setting aside both the fanciful and the insidious theories of puppet masters and cabals, we must realize that there is something new afoot, a huge imbalance in the global distribution of power that concentrates great influence among informal clusters of elites. These elites often transcend or supplant the institutions of the past, national governments, systems of law that could not keep pace with global realities, and even the earnest but incomplete efforts of the past half century at creating effective multinational organizations. At the heart of this new reality are the members of the superclass, individuals whose daily decisions redirect massive assets among markets, create, dislocate, or eliminate jobs around the globe, determine the viability of government programs, sometimes of governments, and also play a vital role in shaping the global era, because so many of the institutions on which we have depended to play such a leadership role in the past have not or cannot because they have grown too weak or obsolete and are ill-suited to the task. Furthermore, these individuals as a group, because of their influence, play a big part in defining the tenor of our times, determining which views are accepted and which are not, and what our priorities are. The influence of this transnational superclass is often amplified as the members act in clusters, knit together by business deals, corporate boards, investment flows, old school ties, club memberships, and countless other strands that transform them, if not into the conspiring committees of legend, then at least into groups that are proven masters at advancing their aligned self-interests. To move beyond the abstractions of political theory and the oversimplifications and absurdities associated with fantasies of secret conspiracies requires that I tell this story as one about people. In order to understand the impact of the superclass, we have to understand who its members actually are. This entailed interviews with more than 100 international leaders in government, business, the military, the media, and religion, as well as extensive digging into the histories of hundreds of others. A census was undertaken, the list I mentioned earlier, surveying various characteristics of the roughly 6,000 selected for the group, their gender, their national backgrounds, where they went to school, their various affiliations, and their personal wealth. Through the interviews I have done and the background information I have collected, a picture begins to emerge, both of the group as it is today and as it is likely to be in the future. Of course, no such analysis takes place only in the limited context of the time it takes to write a book. This book is as much the consequence of my experiences in life as it is of the past 2 years of specific research. Throughout my career, I have encountered members of this superclass and those who aspired to it. My first two jobs, in fact, included working for a prominent Wall Street financier and later for a member of Congress from Brooklyn, New York. Both were superclass aspirants. But because the financier was content with merely being very rich and the congressman was a better policymaker than he was a politician, neither ascended to the first tiers of global influence, although they exposed me to many who did. Subsequently, I worked for a while in television, and then at a series of publications, Financial World, Institutional Investor, CEO Magazine, and Emerging Markets newspapers, which were published by a company of which I was a co-founder, International Media Partners, IMP. We were in the midst of a financial boom, and I had the opportunity to get to know many of the top leaders of the financial community, the group that has been at the vanguard of globalization. From behind the scenes, it was clear that these individuals influenced everything from the way currencies were priced worldwide to which political candidates would have sufficient funding for their presidential campaigns. The people I met from that era included financing titans who were destined for greatness, like future Blackstone CEO Steve Schwarzman and future New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg. A few who later ran afoul of the law, like Michael Milken and Ivan Boesky, godfathers of globalization like Citibank CEO Walter Wriston and Chase Manhattan Bank Chairman David Rockefeller, and countless others in London, Tokyo, Frankfurt, Paris, and other financial capitals. At IMP, we published newspapers covering the big annual meetings of the financial community, like the joint annual meeting of the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and World Bank, and meetings of the regional development banks. At such events, we watched as a few hundred bankers and finance ministers worked together on global financial issues, bailing out failing countries at breakfast, forming alliances over canapes, funding deals at cocktail hour. Of course, occasionally we were also reminded just where we fit in the picture at that time. I vividly recall crossing 59th Street one cold, rainy night to attend a reception at the Plaza Hotel for the King of Morocco, Hassan II. The lighting in the lobby was a soothing golden color, flattering to guests, muting the bustle of the hotel. As I entered the small ballroom in which the reception was being held, there was a receiving line, and immediately before the king was a protocol officer who discreetly leaned forward to ask me my name. I said, David Rothkopf. Mishearing me, his eyes lit up, and he stood up quite a bit more erect and repeated with great reverence, "David Rockefeller." He drew out the last four syllables so each was a complete word. Rock-a-feller. I hated to disappoint him. Heck, given the response, I hated to disappoint me. But I said no, just David Rothkopf. He let out a long sigh that trailed off in a whimper. "Oh," he said, "Your Majesty, may I present Mr. Rothberg?" While at IMP, we also created the CEO Institutes, which ran events on global themes for the chief executives of big companies. Some of these business leaders were chillingly deal-oriented, as I saw at dinner one night when I was seated between the CEO of a leading aircraft manufacturer and Representative Pat Schroeder, then the ranking Democrat on the Armed Services Committee. The CEO leaned across me to speak to Representative Schroeder. "Here's the deal," he said. "I want to sell a plane to Muammar Gaddafi and he wants to buy one, but we have sanctions in place that won't let me sell to him. The U.S. wants this guy dead, so what I'm thinking is, if you help me get the okay to sell him the plane, I'll build it with explosive bolts connecting the wings to the fuselage. Then one day he's up flying over the Med and we push a button. He's gone, I make my sale, everyone's happy." It was so bald-faced that even the experienced Representative Schroeder seemed nonplussed. This CEO had built a fortune by outright asking for what he wanted. Nonetheless, some of the other individuals I got to know at our events were more subtle. Once, at a reception we were holding for former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, I noticed the wife of a prominent diplomat slip out of the room. When I got to the ballroom for dinner, I observed that she had rearranged all the place cards at the head table, shifting me and two other guests, Hank Greenberg, the CEO of AIG, and Fred Smith, the CEO of FedEx, away from Kissinger so she and her husband could sit next to him. Naturally, I restored the arrangement of the tent cards so that I would sit next to Kissinger, whom I had always found a fascinating character. During dinner, he ignored me altogether. He chatted with the few people at the table he wanted to speak with, Greenberg, Smith, and the diplomat among them. This was enormously frustrating. I had been through an entire dinner with one of the world's greatest raconteurs, and I did not have a single story to show for it. Finally, as he got up to give the after-dinner address, he turned to me and, in his famous Teutonic rumble, said, "Mr. Rothkopf?" I eagerly answered, "Yes?" This was my moment to glean a gem. "Let me give you some advice," he offered. "When you are having an after-dinner speaker, it is best if you eliminate the salad course." And with that he stood up and gave his remarks, knowing from experience that our overly long dinner had exhausted his audience and that his lone comment had thoroughly deflated his 32-year-old host. A couple of years later, I joined the Clinton administration as U.S. Deputy Undersecretary of Commerce for International Trade. Once again, I found myself in a job that brought me into regular contact with high-level executives, senior U.S. officials, and other world leaders. Working to remove trade barriers and ensure the enforcement of trade laws, we were unabashed cheerleaders for business-led globalization, involved in everything from helping Raytheon capture a big technology project in Brazil, to helping Exxon develop oil and gas fields off the coast of Indonesia, to helping Boeing secure big aircraft contracts in Saudi Arabia. Immediately following my time in government, I was invited to become a managing director of Kissinger Associates, the international consultancy founded and run by Kissinger himself. It was a small firm, just Kissinger, myself, a former investment banker named Alan Batkin, and a fellow named L. Paul Bremer, Jerry to his friends, who later would go on to fame and not a little controversy as the U.S. administrator in Iraq. Kissinger's office, and indeed his life, was like a revolving door for the superclass. Kissinger was an extraordinary education, brilliant and charming, and a magnet for fascinating people and discussions. Whether he was relaxing at the vacation home of the CEO of ASEA Brown Boveri or hosting a private dinner for the CEO of Gazprom, Kissinger was the master of every occasion, and always knew just how many courses to serve at each meal. I eventually moved on from Kissinger Associates to start a company with Anthony Lake, who was, like Kissinger, a former U.S. National Security Advisor. Together, we launched a firm called IntelliBridge that used open-source web technology to support the intelligence efforts of companies and government agencies. Although the plan was initially to support businesses, we soon found ourselves working primarily within the U.S. national security community. In this capacity, we spent 7 years dealing regularly with the most senior officers of the U.S. military, 3- and 4-star generals and admirals who rival the best in any other part of the government for intelligence, creativity, and character. The venture gave us an inside view of the military-industrial establishment in the United States and around the world. After IntelliBridge was sold, I wrote a book called Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power. I drew on relationships from my time in Washington and ended up interviewing more than 150 leaders of the U.S. foreign policy establishment since the Eisenhower administration. It is a remarkably closed world, as I pointed out in the book. Every U.S. national security advisor since Henry Kissinger has either worked with or for Kissinger, or he or she has worked with or for someone who worked with or for Kissinger. 2 degrees of separation. Many went to the same schools. Many had fathers and brothers in the same line of work. Mostly old white guys, not too many women. A classic elite. So I came to this book with not an insignificant amount of relevant personal experience. Experience that has given me useful perspectives into the connective tissue of the global superclass and introduced me to representatives of the group from every sector and from every region of the world. To have reached the top of the pyramid, it stands to reason that many of the members of the superclass are exceptional. They are often brilliant, full of energy, and creative. They are also lucky, and most of them know it. Many are rather happy. Money, which nearly all these elites have in abundance, doesn't make you happy. But, as Woody Allen once said, money is better than poverty if only for financial reasons. It is hard not to prefer the vision and energy of the best among them to the hidebound narrowness of many of the national political opportunists who sometimes seek to score points by attacking them. But many among the superclass are also deeply self-interested and far removed from the world of most of the people of the planet. One billionaire CEO with whom I spoke responded to the idea of a superclass by saying, only half jokingly, "That's the way it should be. The only thing I'd change is that I should have more power." In his joke was a more serious suggestion that things were actually working better than ever, despite huge global inequalities in the distribution of wealth and power. He did not for a moment question whether his business success should have given him not just more money than other people, but more power than them as well. He felt he had earned the power, too. There have been many books written about the inequitable distribution of wealth on the planet, but few on the inequitable distribution of power. There have been books written about the most salacious and grotesquely appealing theories about the influence of the few, but few that tackle the realities of today's rapidly evolving global elites. Understanding this group is vital to understanding the nature of the global era and the future we are presenting to our children. Further, by examining this group, we may come to question some of our own assumptions, not only about how the world does work, but also how it should work. With some luck, even members of the superclass may see this and recognize that the imbalances that exist are not only unjust, they are the deepest and most deadly threat to their long-term interests. What is more, of course, these are really interesting people. Their stories are often more intriguing than the tabloids and other fiction they inspire. Seeing them up close reveals, in microcosm, much about the world. It is a small enough group that we can focus in on them, see into their eyes a little, and get a glimpse of their perspective. For a moment or two, anyway, we can ride along with people like the former prime minister of a Latin American country, who once settled into the first-class compartment of a long flight, only to discover that he was seated next to a woman who had attended kindergarten with one of his best friends. "Small world," he said.
"Yes," she agreed. "At the top."
David Rothkopf, Bethesda, Maryland, December 2007. Introduction. The Power Elite on the Promenade. Any city, however small, is in fact divided into two, one the city of the poor, the other of the rich. These are at war with one another. Plato, Republic. Gentiana is a small restaurant that would scarcely warrant a second glance in any other village in Europe. It is rather traditional, only slightly more charming than the bland shops and modest hotels around it. One nearby storefront offers a remarkable array of Swiss Army knives, another boxes of chocolates, another fur hats and mountain gear. The restaurant has a cozy neighborhood feel to it. Beside the door there is a blackboard highlighting a few specials, and on the ground floor there may be seating for 20, if they are both thin enough and friendly enough. Upstairs there are a few small rooms for private parties, the biggest of which seats 10 people squeezed in on either side of a long, narrow table. Most of its character comes from a feel of woody intimacy, a dark wood facade, dark wood floors, dark wood tables. In fact, for all its charm, it is definitely not a place for claustrophobes, or people with an extreme fear of splinters. The reason to go to Gentiana is the fondue, especially the cheese fondue, which is offered in robust portions that recall an era before cardiologists.
My wife, Adrian, has a special weakness for fondue, and every year that we have gone to the annual meeting of the World Economic Forum in Davos, we have gone to Gentiana for her birthday. We make reservations long in advance, because during the week of the January meetings, which are attended each year by more than 2,000 business and government leaders from around the world, getting a table at Gentiana is not much easier than getting one at renowned eateries like Aragawa in Tokyo, Gordon Ramsay in London, or Le Bernardin in New York. Perhaps more surprisingly, for that one week, the clientele at this humble Swiss bistro looks pretty much the same as what you might find at those world-class restaurants. Of course, even during that week, there are still a few tables at Gentiana occupied by locals. One regular is a particularly garrulous drunk who loves to hobnob with the CEOs, heads of state, and rock stars who are wedged in, elbow to elbow, spinning hunks of bread on long forks in the pots of bubbling Gruyere. The local speaks only Swiss German to the polyglot crowds around him, and few understand him, although judging by his demeanor, the casual observer is not sure whether that has to do with the language he speaks or the local beer that he favors. No matter, he smiles and they smile, and the general effect is cheerful and relaxed. One afternoon during a recent Davos, my wife and I were hurrying along the sidewalk on our way to Gentiana. This can be dangerous, as the locals do not shovel away the snow, and ice lurks just about everywhere. In fact, attendees at Davos can see with some regularity central bank governors and senior executives of the IMF and other distinguished middle-aged men and women swaddled in cashmere, calfskin, and politically incorrect pelts of many origins launched skyward, only to land on their broader, softer regions. We walked gingerly, therefore, but with purpose, knowing we were meeting our friends in just a few minutes. The weather was typical. A light snow was falling. It was very cold. But the alpine air was crisp and dry and invigorating. We chatted about the meetings, who we had seen and who we hoped to run into. As we walked, we reflexively did what most of the visitors to this small mountain town do. We glanced at the people passing us in the street, trying to determine who they were. Given the nature of Davos, they were likely to have been somebody. It's a ritual made easier by the fact that everyone at the meeting has to wear a badge around his or her neck at all times. The badge is used to get through the many security checkpoints. There are at least 2 Swiss soldiers and policemen in Davos for every delegate who attends the meetings, to register for sessions, and to let everyone know who you are. Your name is on the badge along with the organization you represent. So too is your picture. People tend to walk with their badges dangling in plain sight so they don't have to fumble with them getting in and out of buildings or past police. That's how it was for everyone, except for the universally recognizable. People like Bill Clinton, Bill Gates, Tony Blair, Bono, or Angelina Jolie. The badge scanning move is so ubiquitous you might call it the Davos dip. Bend the knee slightly, cast a subtle glance downward, assess, and move on. Leaving the Congress Center and walking along Davos's main street, the promenade, we passed Thierry Desmarais, the CEO of Total, a small cluster of Harvard professors, a senior executive of Saudi Aramco, and a woman pulling her 2 small children on a sled. She was local, and the sled seemed to hint at the reason they don't shovel the sidewalks. We stopped briefly to chat with Tom Donahue, the CEO of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, who happens to be my wife's boss, then paused a few steps later to chat with an Indian-born U.S. venture capitalist with whom I had some business. It was a typical sample. 5 minutes along the Davos promenade in January offered a cavalcade of freeze-dried economic leaders from 3 continents. About 2 blocks from Gentiana, I was grousing about how one of the conversations that I had most wanted to have had resulted in a frustrating series of near misses. The objective was a long-delayed chat with Paulo Coelho, the Brazilian author of The Alchemist. Coelho had sold more than 100 million copies of his books worldwide, and is, after the Harry Potter author J.K. Rowling, the second best-selling author on the planet. He is also one of the few cultural regulars at Davos, one of a handful of people who might offer a different perspective on the Davos zeitgeist. We had intended to meet almost a year earlier, but due to a series of scheduling mishaps, had repeatedly failed to do so. Finally, we aimed for Davos, but I had yet to lay eyes on him. What did I expect from a man who lived on the other side of the world and was constantly in motion, a Brazilian who lived much of the time in Europe and sold many of his books in Russia? There was a little bit of hubris in thinking we might ever be able to end up in the same place at the same time. And then, "Oh my God," said a voice I did not recognize, "it's you." A smallish man in a fur hat was staring at my name badge. He had a graying goatee, and he greeted me like a long-lost cousin. It was Coelho, appearing almost miraculously out of the alpine mist, as if conjured by our conversation. Passing along the sidewalk from the Congress Center, where we had just heard an address by the German Chancellor Angela Merkel and comments from the Indian steel magnate Lakshmi Mittal, through the stream of big-name boulevardiers, and then walking directly into this icon of the global literary scene, it was made clear again that Davos was truly the incarnation of Marshall McLuhan's global village. It was like small-town planet Earth, or the once-a-year brigadoon of globalization, a community connected to everywhere and, in one way or another, to everyone. Indeed, during the course of this meeting, top trade ministers would caucus to try unsuccessfully to rescue global trade talks, Africa activists would meet with corporate chiefs and political leaders to seek funding for medical aid programs, global warming would go mainstream, as mostly American skeptics were persuaded by session after session of expert views, and proponents of different solutions for dealing with everything from anxiety about immigrants to anxiety about terrorism would present their views directly to those in a position to implement them. If, as Hillary Clinton has asserted, it takes a village to raise a child, this seemed to be the village it took to run the world. Coelho and I had never met, but thanks to the wonders of the information age, we had enough email history that our conversation was familiar and fairly ebullient. He offered to have lunch, but we gestured toward Gentiana, explaining that we had a prior engagement. I eagerly made an appointment to sit down with him later that afternoon at the Congress Hotel. Over the 3.5 decades of its existence, this mountaintop gathering clearly had done more than merely transform Davos from sleepy ski town to cosmopolitan hub. More than a meeting place for the international business, government, media, and cultural leaders, it now was a symbol for the knitting together of the world, literally and figuratively a summit of summits. The concept of what the political scientist Samuel Huntington called Davos Man, the global citizen, the leader for whom borders were increasingly irrelevant, described a new leadership class for our era. When founded in 1971 by Klaus Schwab, the organization that would become known as the World Economic Forum had a narrower mission. It was focused on convening European business leaders for a discussion of that continent's rather uncertain economic fortunes. To put the moment in context, it is worth recalling that in 1971, Europe was still living in the aftermath of World War II and was on the front line of the Cold War, still more the self-anointed seat of civilization than the modern Europe of more modest, less imperial, more multilateralist inclinations. In fact, it was not until 3 years later that the first of Europe's great colonial powers, Portugal, granted independence to Guinea-Bissau, Angola, and Mozambique. The United Kingdom, Ireland, and Denmark did not join the European Union until 1973. Though the Treaty of Rome had initiated the creation of Europe's common market in 1957, it would be more than two decades before the Maastricht Treaty institutionalized the idea of a true single market among the nations of the continent. Europe was clearly in transition at the moment of the Forum's birth. I was in high school at the time, and in college when the World Economic Forum was really gaining its sea legs in the late 1970s. I'll admit, international conferences didn't really capture my imagination when I was a teenager, but my education was absolutely colored with the Western world view of those times, with classical education built on the presumed superiority of European ideas, and the history and cultural contributions of other regions seen as exotic and secondary. At Columbia University, we were required to take the core curriculum, which was built around two major courses. One, humanities, was a survey course of the defining works in literature. The second, contemporary civilization, was a survey of the great works in political philosophy and related disciplines, beginning with the Greeks and continuing through the modern era. The two courses, in retrospect, were undoubtedly the highlight of my education and have benefited me probably every day of my life since I took them. Of course, I did not recognize this at the time. In contemporary civilization, we read, at the pace of one significant, sometimes mind-blowing, occasionally mind-numbing book a week, the writings of everyone, male and white, from Plato to Descartes to Darwin. Somewhere around Max Weber and other analysts and critics of modernity, the curriculum got more varied, with different professors assigning different texts, as it was harder to agree on what qualified as essential reading. One of the more popular assignments at that point in the course was The Power Elite by C. Wright Mills, a 1956 book that explored the national power structure in the United States. Mills, a former Columbia professor of sociology, wrote the book as a study of how America really worked. His central claim was that at the top tier of the business, government, and military communities, there was a remarkably small and overlapping echelon of deciders. This national power elite was composed of men whose positions enable them to transcend the ordinary environments of ordinary men and women. They are in positions to make decisions having major consequences. They are in command of the major hierarchies and organizations of modern society. They rule the big corporations. They run the machinery of the state and claim its prerogatives. They direct the military establishment. They occupy the strategic command posts of the social structure, in which are now centered the effective means of the power and the wealth and the celebrity which they enjoy. Mills asserted that these elites took similar paths to positions of privilege, ensuring that many among their homogeneous numbers knew one another. In addition, they often crossed sectors, from top roles in government to top roles in business, from the White House cabinet to the boardroom, from military commands to politics, from one position of great responsibility to another. Thus, Mills claimed, they created a kind of interlocking directorate for the United States of America. Mills's book was as much a critique as it was a description of this group and America's mid-century leadership. It explored in meticulous detail the concentration of power among a comparatively few corporations and individuals, and the manifold links of American leaders to key institutions. The book then veered into polemic, lamenting the disproportionate influence of this group. One of the men who no doubt inspired many of Mills's points, President Eisenhower, also best illustrated them. A former Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, as well as a former president of Columbia University, Eisenhower captured much of Mills's spirit in his farewell address as president in 1961. The conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every statehouse, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. One little-remembered aspect of Eisenhower's speech is that it contained not one, but two central warnings. While the first, concerning the military-industrial complex, is more often cited, he also expressed equivalent concerns about the emergence of what he called the scientific-technological elite. His concerns, like Mills's, reflect the zeitgeist of the 1950s, in which the predominant historical memory was of World War II and the subjugation of all U.S. political, financial, and industrial efforts to the goal of military victory. The predominant fear of the moment was of technology run amok, as manifested in the growing threat of global thermonuclear war. Since Eisenhower spoke in 1961, technological innovation has not only fueled America's unprecedented growth, but it has empowered people in new ways. It perhaps even helped to bring down the United States' Cold War adversary, as the rise of the information age made it impossible for a closed society to compete. Yet, despite the resilient strength of America's military-industrial establishment, defense spending and manpower have receded from their highs during World War II and the Cold War years. In his speech, Eisenhower speaks of a 3.5 million person military. Today, the U.S. military is only 1.5 million men and women strong, with nearly 1 million more in the reserves. He also notes that at the time of his speech, the U.S. military budget exceeded the total net income of all U.S. companies. Today, while the defense budget exceeds $425 billion, the earnings of only the 50 most profitable U.S. companies top that number. And, indeed, the combined revenues of just the top two, ExxonMobil and Walmart, dwarf it, beating it by more than 50%. Without a doubt, corporate economic clout has grown dramatically. Mills's book is still read and is now considered a classic critique of America's power structure, but it is also clear that the world has changed profoundly in the 50 years since its publication. Crunching through the snow on the Davos promenade after a long, cholesterol-rich lunch, observing the remarkable assortment of world leaders, I found it striking just how much had changed since Mills's day. The distribution of power has clearly shifted, not just away from the United States and Europe, but away from nations. Even the casual observer in Davos would have to conclude that, had Mills been writing today, he would have turned his attention from the national elite in America to a new and more important phenomenon, the rise of a global power elite, a superclass that plays a similar role in the hierarchy of the global era to the role that the U.S. power elite played in that country's first decade as a superpower. Evidence of that new reality was observable in the hotels and cafes and on the frigid sidewalks along Davos's main street. Fortunately, the Congress Center was soon in sight. It was right next door to the hotel Coelho had suggested for our meeting, and, more important, it was warm. The temperature was hovering somewhere between 15 degrees below 0 Celsius, and, holy crap, I have lost all feeling in my extremities. Two Swiss soldiers at the door, both in black uniforms and carrying automatic sidearms, both smiling and saying good afternoon to everyone who entered, checked my badge for the second time in 50 yards and let me into the building. There is a small anteroom in which people typically stomp the snow off their shoes, the mud room of the global elite, followed by a very long hallway along which were scores of coat racks and attendants busily hanging hats and scarves. In the middle of the hallway were metal detectors and guards letting people into the main lobby of the Congress Center. Judging from the badges, there must have been people from at least 20 countries in the hall as I passed through. Virtually all spoke English. Virtually all dressed in a similar uniform, a dark coat, a well-tailored suit or blazer, and slacks. Even the Russians, who just 3 or 4 years earlier were famous for their shiny sharkskin suits. Women were mostly present in their role as spouses, with a still small, though gradually growing number among the actual delegates. Regularly, you could see people, CEOs or government leaders, academics or media people, embrace, warmly shake hands, and greet each other like long-lost buddies. Over the years of Davos and similar meetings around the world, many connections were made and friendships formed within this elite peer group. Listening to the observations of people at Davos and afterward, a similar theme was reiterated about how closely knit this global elite had become, how it had become a community unto itself. Mark Malik Brown, former Deputy Secretary General of the UN and now a foreign ministry official in the British government, recalled a Davos reception held in New York City shortly after 9/11. As my wife and I were walking through that room, greeting friends all the way through, we turned to each other and shook our heads and said, "What happened to us, that we walk through the Davos party and know more people than when we were walking across the village green in the town we live in?" Witnessing the reunions of the superclass in the coat room, one had the impression that while, yes, Davos itself was a small, isolated village high atop a mountain, the same was true for the tiny, insular community that flocked to it every year. Despite differences in their places of origin, the Davos crowd now had more in common with one another than with those who did not live at such a rarefied altitude. A former senior U.S. official confirmed this observation. "I think what is happening is in their own self-identification," he told me. "They have more allegiance to Davos and their ilk than they do to the people at home." Something powerful is happening among the powerful. There have always been national elites like Mills's power elite in the United States. There have always been connections between the elites of different countries, but they were typically foreign relations, connections between distant power centers, discrete alliances between sovereigns. For several decades now, though, a new community has been forming, at the same time that economies are spilling across borders, global entities are proliferating, and the world is, well, flattening. One of the first to observe this phenomenon was the former Citibank chief executive, Walter Wriston, a true visionary of both globalization and the information age. Wriston's prescient and seminal work, The Twilight of Sovereignty, was published within a year of the launch of the World Wide Web in 1991. In it, he wrote that those who fully participate in the information economy benefit most from it. They will feel more affinity to their fellow global conversationalists than to those of their countrymen who are not yet part of the global conversation. A couple of years after Wriston, Christopher Lash observed similarly in The Revolt of the Elites that the market in which the new elites operate is now international in scope. Their fortunes are tied to enterprises that operate across national boundaries. They are more concerned with the smooth functioning of the system as a whole than with any of its parts. Their loyalties, if the term is not itself anachronistic in this context, are international rather than regional, national, or local. They have more in common with their counterparts in Brussels or Hong Kong than with the masses of Americans not yet plugged into the network of global communications. In fact, over the past several years, this particular observation has slipped into fairly common usage. While Wriston accepted the idea from the perspective of a proto-globalist, similar theories have come from critics of globalization who feel threatened by the emergence of this new class without a country. They perceive this international group as a threat to various national communities, from local power elites to the disenfranchised they see buffeted by the choices of the global decision-makers. An example comes from the American free trade skeptic Jeff Foe, who describes in his book, The Global Class War, an illuminating moment. after hearing a U.S. official advocate the passage of the North American Free Trade Agreement because Mexico's Harvard-educated president of the time was, by virtue of his U.S. education, one of us, Foe writes, "I realized that globalization was producing not just a borderless market, but a borderless class system to go with it." He goes on to conclude, "Markets within nations inevitably produce groups of people who have more money and power than others. So it would be odd if global markets did not create an international upper class of people whose economic interests had more in common with each other than with the majority of people who share their nationality." Although I disagree with some of Foe's more extreme anti-global, anti-trade impulses, his concerns about the dislocations caused by globalization are as legitimate as his desire to pin them on the new global leaders is inevitable. He calls the political actors who advance the views of this international elite the Party of Davos. Where Foe and others who have identified this coalescing at the top find common ground is recognizing that something new is happening. As Prince Turki Al-Faisal, the American-educated former Saudi Arabian ambassador to the United States, observed, "I believe the issue of elites is a historic issue. It is not particular to these times. I think ever since the creation of mankind, whether you believe in Darwin or in the revealed religion, there has always been an elite that seemed to be in charge of things in one way or another. But now," he said, pausing thoughtfully, "now this is very different, a different kind of relationship, and something very important but not well understood." The emergence of a different global power elite went unforeseen by Mills 50 years ago. He was still reeling from the breakdown of small-town America and preoccupied with the fact that modest businesses and family farms had been transcended in importance by big corporations and political figures with national influence. If he worried that such concentrated power would not be healthy for American democracy, one could only imagine how he might react to an emerging elite without a country, an elite occupying a global playing field that is, for the most part, unregulated by governments or law. Certainly, others are worried about the rise of this group. Populists and nationalists like Hugo Chavez and Evo Morales in Latin America, Vladimir Putin in Russia, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad in Iran, or Austria's Jörg Haider, France's Jean-Marie Le Pen, or American TV talking heads Lou Dobbs and Pat Buchanan all regularly conjure the threat posed by a global cabal of the rich and powerful who have lost touch with their homelands and who act only in the name of their self-interests and greed. Because this global cabal lacks national ties, it is, by default, unpatriotic in the eyes of the most extreme critics. It poses a threat to culture and tradition and national sovereignty. For these people, Davos is much more than a business conference. It is an enemy camp, the place where the generals of globalization plot their conquests. Because each culture has so diligently knit together the concepts of country and of God over thousands of years, those who look beyond country or see a community of interests that transcend those of their nation are suspected of being very nearly blasphemous or are associated with dark forces. For many, globalization was and is Westernization. Worse, it is Americanization, which in turn links it to Zionism and ancient threats of Jewish conspiracy. It is the collapse of borders and cultural barriers, and thus it conjures for some, somewhat ironically, the spread of Islam. For others, like Dobbs and Buchanan, it is about the Latinization of the United States and the loss of America's Anglo-Saxon identity. In this view, national identities are under siege. For still others in the developing world, the pronouncements of the IMF or WTO seem designed to protect the interests of the rich and conjure the specter of imperialism 2.0, a neo-colonialism overseen by corporate viceroys in which the internet homogenizes the young and turns everyone into a materialist capitalist cog in the global clockwork. In Mills's era, at the height of a global struggle between capitalism and communism, when socialist views were considered intellectually fashionable in American academia because they represented the most direct way to assault the establishment, the study of elites was not just an imperative of social science, essential to understanding how societies function. It was also an examination of the relevance of a core idea of Marxism, that of class. After all, Marx had said at the beginning of the Communist Manifesto, "The history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggles. Freeman and slave, patrician and plebeian, lord and serf, guildmaster and journeyman, in a word, oppressor and oppressed, stood in constant opposition to one another, carried on an uninterrupted, now hidden, now open fight. A fight that each time ended either in a revolutionary reconstruction of society at large or in the common ruin of the contending classes." In the earlier epochs of history, we find almost everywhere a complicated arrangement of society into various orders, a manifold gradation of social rank. In ancient Rome, we have patricians, knights, plebeians, slaves. In the Middle Ages, feudal lords, vassals, guildmasters, journeymen, apprentices, serfs. In almost all of these classes, again, subordinate gradations. Mills was living in a society that distinguished itself from that of its Soviet adversary by its rejection of this notion of class struggle, in particular by its assertion that it had found a solution. A path to a classless society via capitalism, markets, and specifically through the idea of equal treatment of all citizens under the law. When Mills looked around, of course, he did not see anything like a classless society. Without saying it explicitly, his study of American elites resonated with classical Marxist critique. A handful of families controlled the wealth, a handful of companies controlled the means of production, a handful of political and military leaders controlled the levers of power, and they were all linked, sometimes informally, sometimes quite closely, but often with the effect of amplifying their power and securing their station, and implicitly with the consequence of heightening the inequity within society. In short, Mills's study of elites in America at mid-century was tacitly an exploration of the dynamics that lay at the heart of the world's great dilemma of the moment, the choice between capitalism and communism, between a system that subordinated everything to the will of the state, which was asserted to be a steward for the greater good, and one that identified the will of the individual as the central driver for good within a society. Now, the elites of Davos seem to embody the emergence of a new tension, or more properly, an additional one. 50 years after Mills, it seems that these global elites have crystallized a tension between the almost 400-year-old idea of the nation-state as the defining unit of global governance and the emerging reality of a world in which nations are not only diminishing in influence, but are also being transcended, both by transnational needs beyond their reach and transnational power centers advancing internationalist or supranationalist agendas. Internationalist versus nationalist. Globalist versus regionalist. A battle not over the redistribution of wealth, but over the redistribution of sovereignty and power. Mills had, in fact, seen evidence of the first phases of this dynamic, even within the context of Cold War reality, when he noted that, "On each side of the world split running through Central Europe and around the Asiatic rimlands, there is an ever-increasing interlocking of economic, military, and political structures." Indeed, perhaps through this observation he hinted at how Cold War exigencies had helped drive globalizing forces, alliances, trade, infrastructural links, institutional ties among the parties on either side of the East-West struggle. Yet, even acknowledging that the elites of today are different from those studied by Mills, several of the central questions that he raised and that bedeviled his times remain. Despite assertions to the contrary that emerged in the wake of the end of the Cold War, we have not resolved the central debates about how to order our societies. We have not reached, as Francis Fukuyama put it, the end of history, an ideological consensus that the liberal Western view of government and economic life is the best way to order society. Nowhere is this clearer than with the issue that provoked the split between mainstream capitalism and Marxism, that of the just distribution of wealth. Contentious sessions at Davos in 2007 turned on issues like executive pay, and whether it is fair that the average American CEO makes 350 to 400 times what his or her average employee makes. Others touched, with the best of intentions but also an ironic subtext, on the plight of the world's poor as roomfuls of the planet's most privileged pondered the fate of the 3 billion people who live on less than $2 a day. The divide is growing, and some see globalization as being too speed, offering accelerating benefits to some, while others are told to wait. Wait for the process to benefit their children or their children's children. Of course, conflicts between the elites of the world and everyone else are not the only reason such groups are interesting. Understanding who sits atop the social order is essential if one is to understand power, gain it, or oppose it. It is also irresistibly interesting merely to discover who among us are the most successful and powerful, and how their lives are different from our own. It wasn't only the despair of Shakespeare's beset Richard II that led him to say, "For God's sake, let us sit upon the ground and tell sad stories of the death of kings." We have always had a particular fondness for stories of kings. History itself is the story of those with the most to lose, the most to gain, the most power, and the most glamour. Elites are masters of their eras, but they are also metaphors for them. They illustrate what is valued, how success is earned, and how power is garnered and wielded. They also reflect what flaws we tolerate in those at the top, and what flaws we find unacceptable. Indeed, elites reveal how we see our own societies, and throughout history we have created elaborate mythologies to justify and preserve the systems they built or ran. For millennia, power was seen to flow on one hand from heaven and on the other from the ownership of land. These beliefs gave way to the embrace of meritocracy, of Weber's Protestant ethic, and the rags-to-riches appeal of Horatio Alger. What do the crowds at Davos say about our time, about how it is different from previous eras, about what changes may be yet to come? What is their current mythology? And what does it say about the rest of us? After a time of schmoozing and restoring my body temperature at the meeting center, I pressed on to my late afternoon appointment. The Congress Hotel, where I was now headed to meet Coelho, is one of the best places to stay while attending the World Economic Forum's annual meeting. It is certainly unassuming. That is not surprising in Davos, where, other than the traditional Grand Hotel style of the Belvedere, where most of the topmost government and business leaders stay, virtually every hotel looks like the kind of modest place you might expect in a mid-level European ski resort. As a consequence, Davos imposes a certain kind of situational humility on the exalted of the world, or, in the case of the worst hotels, even humiliation. One senior Latin American official complained of being boarded atop a mountain in a ski lodge that required a cable car and a bus ride to transport him, 45 minutes later, to the Congress Center. One very distinguished American NGO head was placed in a 1.5-star hotel that was practically in Klosters, the next town down the road. Some people rebel and commute into Davos from Zurich, 3 hours away, or, as one Persian Gulf sheikh did, they helicopter in from better digs elsewhere. My wife and I, in view of our own less than lavish accommodations, tried to imagine that we were in touch with Davos's roots as a destination for a spa cure, literally the place about which Thomas Mann wrote The Magic Mountain. Mann, of course, had no idea quite how magic the mountain would become. Walking through the metal detector into the welter of activity in the Congress Hotel's lobby, it was once again clear. A small pride of women swaddled in mink and all manner of tasteful bling glided past, looking vaguely predatory and, frankly, frightening. Behind them came their husbands, a group of U.S. senators, including John McCain of Arizona. In the tiny lounge area, a group of Brazilian officials had cordoned off the conference space for the imminent arrival of Brazil's president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, almost certainly the only Davos attendee that year with only a fourth-grade education. Next to where I settled in the lounge, a lively discussion was taking place about a major charitable initiative to raise money for a healthcare NGO doing work in Africa. Africa had been the theme of Davos for the past couple of years, thanks to high-profile activists like Bono, the earnest Improving the World commitment of Klaus Schwab, and the presence of the likes of Angelina Jolie, though there were not very many African government or business leaders attending. I ordered a Diet Coke and eavesdropped while waiting for Coelho to arrive. Two people from an NGO were speaking to, apparently, a potential donor, trying to shake loose some funding. One mentioned a donation that the benefactor's group had made during the most recent meeting of the Clinton Global Initiative, CGI, a similarly high-level forum organized in New York by the former president to mobilize support for important international causes. CGI had clearly tapped into what many perceived as a hot trend of the moment, philanthropy. Some $7 billion had been committed at the Clinton event, dedicated to specific projects addressing mainly global health, poverty alleviation, and education. Indeed, in the era of record gifts to philanthropy, such as Warren Buffett's $31 billion provided to the Gates Foundation, one senses that a major issue global elites seek to discuss, or like to be seen discussing, is their own generosity. The charity craze is a good thing, but why is it happening now? It could be related to the business cycle. Aging internet and hedge fund millionaires and billionaires, for example, seek to be more generous in hopes of leaving a legacy. It could also be associated with the cyclical rise and fall of elites. Elites of an age known for breathtaking growth in inequity might seek to do damage control before the inevitable backlash comes. The late 19th century American social critic Thorstein Veblen would have recognized the development. The man who coined the term conspicuous consumption to explain what the rich spend their money on, ostentations, would probably simply see at least an element of this as a piece of the same cloth. He would probably observe that for all the very considerable good that is done by CGI and at Davos, the spirit of the times, or at least of the events, also leads at least some of the world's elites to wear conspicuous conscience, as they might a new Rolex. Coelho appeared on time and settled in at our small table. He would not have been mistaken for the CEOs or senators in the room, having adopted a deliberately bohemian quality, with a bright orange scarf draped around his neck, his gray hair cropped close except for a small rectangle of slightly longer hair at the nape of his neck that seemed to offer a kind of back-of-head counterpoint to his goatee. A former lyricist for leading Brazilian composers and a former hippie, he is of another time and place in many respects. He was so relaxed and seemingly guileless that the New Yorker in me started out by assuming that his openness was a kind of affectation. But after only a few minutes talking, I developed the sense that he was very much who he seemed to be. In this respect, he did have something in common with the chief executives and government leaders in the room, whose success gave them less to prove. So it was with Coelho, one of the most popular authors in history. When you have 100 million books in print and national governments and leading organizations are offering you medals and plaques and other knickknacks of professional status, you certainly don't have to defend yourself to the world as you once might have. So how does the hippie who has attended the past 10 Davos meetings see the inner workings of the system? Does he identify with other members because of his success and influence? Or does he feel like an outsider, an anthropologist visiting the village of the ultra-powerful? How does the allegorist view this group that defines the emerging power structure of our time? In a way that would not be much of a surprise to anyone who has read any of Coelho's works, he began to describe Davos in terms of its mythology. He said, "The classical myth about Davos is that they are here to divide up the cake, to get their piece. But that's not my vision. I think there are two levels in Davos, today more than ever, because I have been coming here for 10 years. The one is the business level. I don't fully understand it, but they have real money. They have power. It is part of their reason for coming. But there is another level, a second level, that is the human level, and it is a bigger and bigger part of the meeting. It creates a kind of constructive self-consciousness. Who are you? What about your identity? Are you your company? Are you your country? Are you something else? Are you yourself? And how do you integrate being yourself and being what you do? It enables us, at the end of the day, to get past the political discussions, the business discussions, to what we really believe as human beings. It lets people get acquainted more and more with the human side. So we have an elite meeting, yes, but not to regulate the world, but to see each other."
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.